Hello everyone, welcome back to DCU Podcast on Career Conversations. My name is Siobhan Murphy, a careers advisor here in the Career Service in DCU, and I'm very happy to invite people to really have a good listen today about how you can develop your career in the, any of the EU institutions. So I'm joined here today by Eimear Ní Bhrim, who works in the European Commission, and Owen Lavelle, who is Third Secretary of the DFAT. So one of the things that I want to really, really focus on is that, you know, Ireland is very much part of the EU. It's extremely important to us. As the same, we're an island nation, but we have been very pro-European from the very, very beginning. So it's really important that Irish people are out there in the EU institutions, not only doing the work of the EU, but also flying the flag for Ireland. So, but how do you get into it? So I'm going to start off first with yourself, Eimear. How did you end up working for the
How did I end up where I was? Yeah. So at the moment, I work on promoting multilingualism and trying to get people to apply for the different jobs in the EU institutions. But I would have gone, in some ways, in a roundabout way, I would have started in organisations like the European Movement, for example. I worked there for a couple of years. I worked in the Maltese embassy as well. I worked in an embassy based here in Ireland. And then a job came up in the European Parliament. And at the time, it was difficult to find people with languages and who had an interest in EU affairs and who could explain or communicate what was going on in the European Union. The European Union wasn't quite as popular as it is right now at the time. So there was a lot of explaining to do. I worked as a press officer there for a couple of years. And then one of these competitions, or the concours, came up and I applied for a permanent job in the EU institutions. And got it.
So, and what was your own undergrad?
I did European Studies in Trinity College initially, and then came over to DCU to do a Master's in International Relations. So,
yeah. And that was all that, you know, do the Master's in the International Relations, that's all prior to you going to work with the EU Commission, or was it all kind of happening in around the same time?
It was prior to it. So I would have gone from the Master's. I actually went to Guatemala for a while. I wanted to learn more languages, but I also wanted to get work experience. So I was lucky enough to find a language school that gave us placements in different organisations. So we worked with cooperatives, trying to look at where they could sell their produce and how they could develop websites and things like that. So I did that for a while. And it was only then when I came back that I applied for a job in the European Movement, as I mentioned, as an intern initially. And then the press officer left and I became the press officer. And that's how it started.
You put yourself in the way of opportunities, yes, yeah. I suppose. And yeah. That's what sometimes it's very hard just to apply for the perfect job. Sometimes it's about getting into the organisation first.
That's it.
Yeah. And then, I suppose, manoeuvring and going for promotion, looking for transfers and finding your own niche. I mean, when you were in college, did you say to yourself, oh, well, you want to be a press officer? I mean, what was going on for you?
No. I have to say, when I was applying for the CAO, I did have an interest in journalism and what it was. And I did want to apply for journalism here in DCU at the time. Mm-hmm. But what stopped me was that I decided I needed to have something to write about. Actually, I'm going back, that sounds very traditional right now. But I wanted material, and I had an interest in languages, in politics and the EU institutions, in history. So that's how I ended up going in that direction. So I went to European Studies then and loved it. I don't regret it at all. Mm-hmm. And had intended then doing a master's in journalism or things like that. But it's just, I suppose,
yeah,
I ended up with
just
this interest.
In
international relations.
Oh, yeah. So that's the important thing to remember.
Yeah. I would have been interested in communicating with the media and all of this kind of thing. So
you have to marry it all together
by accident. It's just being in the right place at the right time.
Okay, so now just thinking now, say, about anyone that might be considering a career in the EU and they're still doing their degree, or perhaps, you know, in their early career at the moment, you know, how do you go about it?
But I think the most important thing to look at is to be ready to, I think Owen and I have spoken about this a few times, to be ready to get your foot in the door rather than to expect the permanent job from day one. I think there's a huge focus on having the permanent pensionable job. There are other ways in, and there are other ways of doing it. And I think it's a thing of looking at the traineeships, looking at the different contract opportunities that are available, keeping an eye on all of the efforts to promote the opportunities in Brussels in particular, and not just with the EU institutions, working with some of the organisations that are lobbying the EU institutions as well, with a whole range of different interests.
So I can imagine Brussels and Strasbourg, maybe to a lesser extent, like all the business of those two cities is probably EU related, you know, whether it's an NGO that has a presence there or a think tank, I'm always pronouncing that very badly,
or legal firms
or so on and whatever. So I actually might just bring in your cell phone. Okay, so you currently work as a third secretary in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. I know you have a special responsibility around promotion of EU careers. You might be able to explain your role a little bit more.
Sure. So thanks for having me, first of all. I am a third secretary, which is, I guess, another term for junior diplomat in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. So for those listening who don't know, the department represents Ireland abroad and manages our relationship with the EU institutions and with other countries as well. So I'm based currently in the EU division, and our division I'm based in manages our relations with EU member states and with the institutions themselves as well. So as part of my job, I am promoting awareness of the vacancies that are out there for Irish people in the institutions, and to really try and encourage students now to think about a career in EU affairs, not just in Brussels, as you said, but around Europe. And I think the variety of opportunities within the institutions themselves is probably something people aren't aware of. Mm-hmm. So I'd encourage people to take a look at that as they consider the next steps.
I suppose it's kind of thinking about the analogy of, right, that it is a form of civil service. And, you know, in our own civil service here in Ireland, there's grades and different categories of staff, but they do a lot of interesting work. And the name of the role doesn't always explain the diversity of the role that you're doing. Do you know what I mean? Like your third secretary role, you know, what is that? If you know, so you're kind of thinking that you've got special responsibilities, so you end up working on very interesting projects.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things of the role that I'm doing at the minute is that the variety it offers is something that I think people... Mm-hmm. probably who apply are thinking about first and foremost in their career, is someone who wants to have a lot of change in their career, who's willing to move around the world, of course, because we're expected to go on posting abroad. Similarly, for those who go to Brussels to work for the institutions, it's not the case that you'll get a job, a pensionable job for life, as Eimear mentioned, and you'll stay at the same desk for 40 odd years. There's an incredible array of opportunities there for people, not just people who've studied international relations or law like myself, even, but people who've studied with science backgrounds, accounting and auditors, there's architects even that are employed by the EU, so there's a wide range.
Engineers,
absolutely.
IT people.
Anything that you mentioned, anything that people are studying in DC at the minute, is a skill that can be transferred to the EU level. Yeah.
And you mentioned that you studied law yourself. Mm. And have you a language, or did you work abroad? You know, what has positioned you, A, to be a third secretary, and B, to take on the mantle of the promotion of the EU?
So I think maybe the first thing listeners should be aware of is that there's no traditional career path into the institutions or certainly into the department either. And everyone that I work with and that Eimear works with will have done different things before they enter into the job they're in at the minute. I myself personally studied law with French in Cork, and that involved a year studying abroad in Strasbourg. And then subsequently I did a master's in European law in the College of Europe, which is based in Bruges in Belgium.
I might pick you up in the College of Europe, if you don't mind, because I suppose I'm hopping off you about your own experience there. I suppose some of our students would be interested in doing a postgrad study in the College of Europe. And I know even the Department of Education and Skills actually provide grants. I know the European movement here promoted here in Ireland as well. So you've had the lived experience. Maybe you might share us.
First thing to remember, maybe just practical point of information, is that there are 3 scholarships available every year from the Department of Education to go to the College of Europe. Applications are open every autumn and close at the end of January, essentially. So for those thinking about it, possibly applying for the next academic year, it's too late at the minute. Mm-hmm. But for the following one, applications will be open in autumn this year. It's a fantastic place to work, to study. I really can't recommend it highly enough. One thing that I should mention is that the masters are taught through English and through French, so you need to have a high enough level of French to study whatever subject you're studying, be it law, international relations or politics, through both English and French. So that's certainly a challenge, possibly for some students, but not those who would have a high level of French already.
So am I right in saying then, you know, if I'm working on my French, and it's fairly decent, I could study through English and then work on the side on improving my French while I'm
Absolutely.
There, ready to maybe compete for positions then using French.
Absolutely. And one of the things that the College of Europe gives you, but also people who are studying here and using languages as well, is the preparation needed to actually pass the Concours, as you mentioned, which involves obviously assessments not only in English but also in a second language, be it Irish or another European language, French or German, most commonly.
I might bring back yourself, Emer, then about the language, you know, because obviously one of your roles is the promotion of not if one language, multilingualism. So we seem to have a bad reputation in Ireland around our skills in languages, but are we all that bad?
Well, I think there's an issue here in terms of confidence as well. I mean, I've spoken to some DCU students, for example, who actually do have languages. They're in their toolkit, but they don't have the confidence in the level they have reached. And sometimes it's a question of just getting that level and doing something with it, not letting it drop. You've done your work on it. You've done the Leaving Cert, let's say. You've done everything. It's in there somewhere. So there are people in this country who do have the language skills. So it's not a question of saying that we don't have them here, throwing the baby out with the bathwater. We have a number of graduates, we have a number of people who are in college now who do have these languages. So it's a question of just seeing if they can bring them out, dust them off and do something with them while they're in college, outside of college or after college.
So I know there's obviously, if languages isn't part of your degree here in DCU, we still do have paired learning. So if you have some level of a language, you can work on your skills while you're here. And obviously you can go to the language institutions in towns, Alliance Française, Growth Institutions, Cervantes Instituto. You know, so there is a number of range of options. That's really about embracing it.
That's it.
And seeing where it might bring you. Will it bring you into your EU career? We're not sure. But you have to put yourself in the way of the opportunity, I suppose, is the key message.
And languages also, like not just the EU institutions, but languages will give you something anyway. It'll bring you somewhere, whether it's a job or an adventure or travelling or all sorts of things.
Yeah.
So it's a win-win.
You're putting the destination, just get on the journey of it, and you never know where it might bring you to.
Absolutely.
And at the worst case scenario is you're well able to communicate when on holiday, and
that's it.
And and sometimes we just, as you said, I think your point was well made earlier, that there's kind of a degree of perfectionism, you know, around languages, and you know that people feel they have to be excellent.
Yes.
Whereas that when we meet people and their first language is not English, we're hugely tolerant, and once they're communicating very well to us, we catch the message, we move it on.
That's it, yeah.
Some things might be a little bit,
we just have to spit it out.
We just have to get it out, and we get there in.
Yes.
So that's really, really important. So just bringing us back to, say, students that are here at the moment or even at their early careers, what might be a useful kind of first step to explore a career in the EU? You know, so you were saying about the permanent jobs, there's contract, there's traineeships, you know, so what are all of them, and, you know, what would you might apply for first?
Well, I think both of us, Owen and I, would both strongly recommend that people look at the traineeship first.
Okay.
It's not that has...
I think it has another word, stagiaire or something?
A stage, or stage. Yeah, is the actual person. But so traineeship or internships, or
sure.
So the different institutions will call it different things. But in general, you're talking about the short-term immersion in an institution. So if you go in on, and I know, for example, EU Jobs has their Twitter feed, the European Movement has their, they highlight these opportunities as well. But if you go in on EPSO, on the personnel services of the EU institutions, and look at traineeships, you can see, you can start, it's a starting page where you can look at all of the different institutions, what they offer.
You might give us the spelling of EPSO.
So it's EPSO.
.eu.
But I would say that, you know, EU Jobs, the Department of Foreign Affairs, runs this EU Jobs initiative as well. So you can find that on Twitter, on social media. Owen will speak about it. And the European Movement has a newsletter it sends out every Thursday. So even here, absolutely. It's a question of Googling. Use Google.
Yeah, I know.
And find it. I mean, there are a lot of opportunities out there. But the different institutions offer different types of traineeships. They have different closing dates. It's a question of the students going and investigating this and working out. The European Commission's one is 5 months. It happens twice. But the lead-in is very, very long. Like, you need to apply from months in advance.
Yeah.
And the level needed for languages, for example, is quite high. The other institutions don't have the same requirements. You can apply for an internship without other languages. So it's just a question of looking at what suits you. Go in there, see what it's like, get the opportunity.
Apply and see what happens.
Yes.
Okay. You know, don't say no to yourself.
That's it. Yeah.
In life. Which brings me back to you, Owen. You know, so Department of Foreign Affairs are active in this area. So what sort of services do you offer or services might be the right word, but you know, what do you do?
So as part of the EU Jobs campaign, I guess it's kind of, there's two main things that we do. One of them obviously is the promotion of EU jobs around Ireland, and our outreach to universities is a strong part of that. And the second thing that we do is we help Irish people who are applying for permanent jobs in the EU. So for those students who are thinking of a long-term career in the EU, obviously the first step should be to apply for a traineeship. But the next step, if they're thinking about longer term, is to apply for a permanent job. And there we offer a wide range of supports for people who want to sit one of the concours or the assessment stages for an EU permanent competition. And so what we offer there will be tailored to the specific competition that the person is going for, the type of job they're going for, and what the requirements for that job are. But I would encourage people who are thinking about sitting the test for a permanent job in the EU to reach out to us. We have a mailing list on our website, which is dfa.ie/EU jobs. And there they'll find all the information they need. But if they have any further questions, I man an email inbox there and they can contact us directly with any further questions.
Okay, so you have, I suppose, some supports for people who are getting to that stage.
Absolutely.
Of the ETRE exercises, mm-hmm. or the interview stage or the assessment centre stage, is
yes.
that what?
For all stages,
yeah,
we offer help, and it will be tailored, again, as I said, to the individual competition and the stage that the individual is taking at that time.
Yeah.
This is an incredible opportunity that wouldn't have been available beforehand. This is new.
Yes, this is
yeah.
wasn't around a few years ago,
no.
but I've had conversations
yeah.
with prior incumbents of your
yeah.
role,
yeah.
and this is definitely.
So for the first time, there is, you know, when people apply and they're at that stage, they've gotten past, there's actual help available in Ireland to do this instead of having to go digging looking for it. So I think that's a very valuable thing, and it's something to take away from this, that the government is trying to help people.
Yeah, like they're trying to put you
yeah.
in the way of these
yeah.
jobs, not going to go again, as the saying goes. So just back over to, say, contract work. Okay, have you any insights to share about that, Eimear? Like what are the typical type of contract, or are they just completely randomly across the institutions?
Well, there are different types of contracts. One of the, for example, a position we're advertising at the moment, we're looking for translators. We're looking for a lot of Irish language translators. But one of the positions we have open at the moment is looking for temporary officials. So these are very good contracts because you get the same conditions as an official or as an EU civil servant, but for a more temporary period. So in this case, 4 years, plus an additional 2, possibly, to add to it.
Well, in this day and age, there's nothing really temporary about 4 years plus 2, really.
Well,
this is it.
To me, this is an incredible opportunity
yeah.
for people who would happen to have that level of accuracy mm-hmm. in Irish, who would be able to apply for it. But there's that type of contract, and actually that's how I came in. On that type of contract.
Excellent. And it served you well.
It served me very well because I came in on those conditions, very good conditions. The only thing that's different is that it ends. There's an end period. But there are other contracts that are slightly less in terms of years, lesser pay and things like that. And they're available at various stages. Again, if you look at the EPSO, at the EPSO website, you can see them. The job opportunities are broken down into the types of contracts available. And the likes of the Department of Foreign Affairs and the European Movement will promote these opportunities when they come up to show people that these opportunities are available for Irish people. Mm-hmm. But definitely, it's a question of keeping your eyes open. I'll often say to people that you need to open that EPSO account. You need to set up that profile.
Can you register alerts and something about?
You can, but you need to keep an eye on it. Go in on the website, set up that CV. That's the bit that takes time. There is a bit of effort involved, and reading the instructions. Owen and I were talking about this again. Part of the problem is that people don't read the instructions in terms of application forms and things, and we lose people. They never get to the competition stage because they just read the instructions in the wrong way. They fill it out with the wrong ticking, the wrong boxes. It's as simple as that. And that's it.
Right.
And you're out. Now you can apply again, but you'll have to wait.
And that's the most important thing to remember with anything like EPSO is, and it's a bit like our own civil service in Ireland, you can apply and apply again. Just because you get knocked out of one competition doesn't prevent you getting into other competitions.
That's a very important point because I know I get asked about that a lot. Does it come back to haunt you,
yeah.
basically? And it doesn't.
No.
And that's a very important point to emphasise.
I think anyone that I've met that has either got into the civil service in Ireland or into the EU institutions most would say they didn't get in on the first attempt.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. It took a couple of goals to kind of break through. Now, there is obviously exceptions to the rule, and people do get in the first day out.
No, but it's funny actually, but it's funny, it doesn't happen very often. But we were talking about this, different competitions suit different people.
Sure.
When I did the Concours, it was very different.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the way
but
it is
now. You
already
had a contract position for a while.
I was in,
you
yes.
knew what you were doing, you weren't blind.
Yeah, no, and I think I've said before, I was asked when it came, there was an essay writing section, and I was asked to design a campaign for the European elections. That's what I was working on in my job. So I basically wrote out what we were planning to do. And that was my essay for the Concours. So I was ready for that competition.
That's real action learning altogether.
Well, this is it. But it's why Owen and I are emphasising that getting the traineeship, getting the foot in the door, it doesn't matter how you do it, that when you're inside, you see the inside, you can speak the language, whether it's of the EU institutions or the Irish Civil Service. Being on the outside, we can explain all of this, but when you see it for yourself, it's much easier to write that down then or portray it in an interview process.
Now, I know we're doing a separate episode around developing your career using Irish language skills, but we might just touch to it here just for a roundedness.
Absolutely.
For this episode itself. So, you know, you mentioned translators, but, you know, tell us a little bit more about opportunities in the EU using
Irish. Well, as many people will know, I think at this stage, the Irish language, we're hoping, will have the same status as the other languages from 1st of January 2022. So only a little bit away from us now. But in order to do that, we need to be able to translate everything into Irish as it is done for the other languages. Also, we need our politicians, for example, Irish politicians, to be able to speak in Irish and have it interpreted into the other languages, no problem. We need the lawyers ready to be able to check the texts, because in an Irish context, the Irish language version legally is more important. So it's just a question of being ready for all of this. So we need all of these professional people, and not just for the 1st of January 2022. We've already started building this up. This is something the government asked for a couple of years ago. So we've been working on it, building up the services. But we will also need people down the line. We're going to need a pipeline of people.
Well, if it's getting approved, therefore, one would hope it would never get unapproved again.
No,
it will be a long-term proposition.
But that's the thing, because people seem to think that we just need people now. We are going to need people. These jobs are going to be there. And we'll need a lot of people to do it.
And we need a pipeline of
yes.
really good talent
yeah.
coming through.
Yeah, so the people who are in university now, there will be jobs. They're not going anywhere for the next while, as long as we can prove that we can get people in the next while to comply with the 1st of January 2022. That's my challenge for now.
Yeah, and just for anybody, say, okay, we'll have different categories of people who have skills with Irish, like the native speakers. You'll have people who went to Gaelscoileanna and Manscoileanna, and people who have studied Irish at third level. You know, we'll have a range there of talent, but it's try and get the assessment. You know, what sort of an assessment would that still come under the European framework? You know, like B2, C1, C2.
You self assess under that framework, but really, in terms of a translation job, what's important is accuracy. It doesn't matter how you got there. You can have grown up speaking it, or you can have done it in college, or as you say, there are so many different pathways. The question is, can you accurately decide what is grammatically correct or not?
But also, it's more than grammatically correct. I would have thought it would have to be contextualised correct.
Yes, so for that's the level of Irish.
Sure.
So that's a different. So the level of Irish is very important, because it's something, for example, like I grew up with it, but I couldn't explain to you grammatically why one thing is picked over another.
Yeah, you just know.
Yeah.
That's the right
so
word.
So in some ways, yeah. I mightn't be the best candidate for that kind of job.
Yes.
But what is very important, of what we've seen, is getting these translators who have a grasp of what is going on in the EU institutions. And not only what is going on in these EU institutions, because they're able to read these texts, they're able to understand what the context behind them is, but also being able to look at the different audiences. So translators translate legislative texts, but they also translate publications for members of the public. They translate texts to go on websites. They translate videos that we would use. So there are so many different types of things. The European Parliament is now looking at the more cultural side of the translation thing. So when they're bringing in translators now, they want them to be able to engage with members of the public in the different languages. So translation is no longer about, you know, the book and the, yeah. the dictionary, and it's not just about that. But what is key, the key qualification, is the level of accuracy the person will have. And that is the bottom line.
And obviously, in the assessment of that, you know, there's obviously e-tray exercises. What would be the assessment that if anyone was going for a job in, for even a contract job, because I'm sure most would start off a contract job initially, you know, what would be the assessment there that he was using, do you know?
So, for example, for the current one I mentioned there, that we have an open competition for the contract position, there is no e-tray exercise, actually. The first test is a proofreading text. So you're asked to see what's wrong with it. And if you manage to pass that test, they'll correct your translation text. So there are two tests that they will do in the centres here in Ireland.
Fantastic. You don't have to travel, there's no cost.
So that's where they'll start. Yeah.
And then you'll get through the next level, obviously, and then you get into
And then you get to the interview stage and all that kind of stuff.
That would be Oscale as well.
You do need a little bit of that. But you won't get past. I mean, we will very quickly be able to see the proofreading thing, for example, is the first stage. And they don't go towards, because it's a lot of time and effort to correct all of these exams. So they won't actually correct the translation test unless the proofreading one worked.
Well, it makes sense because, I mean, you know, if you're able for it, it's very easy to see it.
Exactly.
And if it's not, you need to.
It's the quickest way of moving the whole process along.
Yeah, and everyone will know where they stand after that. So just to wrap up, Michael, back to yourself, Owen, anyone thinking about a career in the EU, what's your top tip?
Well, look, I think bear in mind that there are many, many different paths to a career in the EU. One of the best ways, and we'll always say it, is that to look first at the traineeships at the start. They last 5 to 6 months. It's a great way of seeing exactly how the institutions work, what type of work you'll be expected to do if you choose it as your career in the long term. And there certainly are not, it's not 5 months of photocopying or stapling papers together. It's real policy work in most cases. It's real substantive work, and it's a great work experience, even if you don't go on to work in the EU afterwards. Many, many employers see it on your CV and it stands out. So I think it's definitely something worth trying or considering it as a first step.
Mm-hmm. And yourself, Emer?
I think
he's robbed that one.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Well, I think if I bring the focus back to DCU for the moment, if we're speaking to DCU students, the one piece of advice I would give would be to use your time in university, use your career service, practice your interviews, use the services that are available to you, because you get out there into the big bad world and there aren't as many people there to help you.
Sure.
And I think now is an opportunity to try these things. I think group interviews are difficult personally, but you can practice these things. And I think now is your time. Now is your chance to become better, to become more assertive is probably the best word, because I think Irish students and graduates could do with a little bit of a boost in that department.
So what I'm hearing from you is that you're going out there competing with the rest of Europe for these positions, and we'll have to get our shoulders back and say, we want those jobs.
And be confident in what you have in your toolkit, basically.
Yeah. Brilliant. Listen, thanks so much for today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.